Poletti versus Overlake Hospital Medical Center.
Good morning.
Morning.
I'm Mary Spillane, and I represent the petitioner, Overlake Hospital Medical Center. There are several issues before the court on this appeal.
Rebuttal?
Huh?
Rebuttal?
Oh, I'm sorry. Yes, I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal. And the issues are whether the trial court erroneously granted plaintiff's motion for summary judgment, erroneously ordering three things. First, that Overlake is not entitled to immunity under RCW 71-05120 because Overlake did not detain Sherry Poletti and the Involuntary Treatment Act was not implicated at any time. Secondly, that the ordinary medical malpractice standard of care, rather than the gross negligence standard of liability under RCW 71-05120, is the liability standard to be applied in this case. And lastly, that Overlake's failure to follow a hospital policy relating to referrals to the King County mental health professional for assessment constitutes negligence as a matter of law. The court erred in all of these respects. This case hinges, plaintiff's wrongful death claims, hinges on Nurse Short's decision whether to discharge Ms. Poletti or to detain her for evaluation by a mental health professional. Without that decision, there would be no claim in this case. Under the Involuntary Treatment Act, and in particular RCW 71-05050, unless Nurse Short regarded Ms. Poletti, who was voluntarily admitted and was requesting discharge, as presenting an imminent likelihood of serious harm or gravely disabled, Nurse Short had no choice but to immediately discharge her.
Well, let me ask you about a sort of a peripheral question. I think
sure.
I understand your argument on the main points, but one of the kind of peripheral issues is, what you just said. You said that everything flows from the decision to discharge, but there are arguments in respondent's brief about how apparently there was a deposition and a number of things came out that during the time that she was in the hospital arguably committed a number of acts of negligence. And so, I mean, I think your position is that those acts, the failure to monitor her sleeping patterns, for instance, all fold into the decision to discharge, because if anything caused her death, that's what did. But is that something this court really needs to reach? I mean, it seems like on discretionary review to go through all the possible acts of negligence and try to thread them into all possible theories of causation is something that really hasn't been addressed at the trial court. I'm just wondering whether you have considered the possibility that even if you are correct about the main issue and the standard that is found in the Involuntary Commitment Act of gross negligence, that there may be some acts that might, to which ordinary negligence might apply.
I think that under the statutory scheme, there is a potential that there could be some acts, if they were causally connected to the claimed injury, that could be evaluated under ordinary negligence.
For example, one of the things that's argued is that things that happened after she was discharged, they could have told her this and that and the other thing, which I realize was not really hashed out in the trial court.
And that was not even part of the case at that point in time. The informed consent claim, they moved to amend their complaint to add it. That amendment was denied with prejudice because of the stay. So informed consent was not even an issue in the case at the time. And that order denying the motion to amend can be found at, now I can't put my finger on it.
That's right.
I can get you the it is in the record. And the motion to amend that's also in the record is clear that it was to add that very informed consent claim. I think that our position with respect to ordinary negligence is there could be circumstances. For instance, if the patient was given medication improperly and developed a skin rash or anything else that caused damage, that would be evaluated under ordinary negligence. What we're concerned with, because under RC,
well, what if she were, and I mean, just to make it a little bit more realistic, suppose she were given the wrong medication, and after she got out of the hospital and started driving, that medication kicked in.
That would be evaluated under the ordinary negligence standard, because it wouldn't relate to the decision whether to discharge, release, or detain the patient for evaluation and treatment. But because this case is about the decision to discharge or detain, and the decision was made to discharge, not detain, it falls within the immunity provision of RCW 7105.120, and the gross negligence standard applies with respect to that. Whether they get to put on evidence relating to all of those other acts as a buildup that they claim were negligent during the course of her stay at Overlake, building up to the decision to discharge or detain, they may be able to use those to try to establish that there was gross negligence ultimately in that decision, but it is the decision to discharge or detain that drives liability in this case.
In the trial court, or perhaps not explicitly, but perhaps you yourself have thought about this, if this case were to go to trial, have you pictured the set of instructions that the jury would be given? Isn't it true that the jury has to be given an instruction on ordinary negligence in order to understand the instruction on gross negligence?
They may be told what the difference between the two is, or they could be given an instruction just on gross negligence. Whether they really need an instruction on ordinary negligence except to differentiate it from gross negligence is something that remains to be determined, because, again, the acts of other negligence, of ordinary negligence that they're claiming, apart from the decision to discharge or detain, may have no causal connection.
The comments to the WPI gross negligence instruction contemplate that the jury has to understand what ordinary negligence is in order to understand what gross
negligence is. And I haven't gone back to look at instructions because we weren't at that stage yet. But clearly, if I don't have a problem with the jury understanding the distinction between the two so that they can evaluate this case on the gross negligence standard with regard to the decision whether to discharge or detain. Thank you.
Good morning.
Good morning.
May it please the court, I'm Mike Goldfarb for the respondent, Nicole Paletti. All three daughters of Sherry Paletti are present today in the court. Before I sort of launch into the details of the argument, I think there's a threshold point that needs to be made clear. No matter how many times Overlake says that Nurse Short made this decision, that's simply not the case. This decision is made by the attending physician, who is in this case Dr. Mathiason. Nurse Short has an administrative role at the hospital, and her role is to fulfill the various duties that a nurse in her position has to fulfill, which is properly reading the chart, properly communicating, things of that nature. But the suggestion that Nurse Short had the discretion here to make the decision to discharge is absolutely belied by the record in this case.
Well, whether she did or didn't officially have the discretion, wasn't she the one who let Mrs. Paletti go?
Well, what happened was that she miscommunicated first, well, to sort of back up, and I think Your Honor's point was really directly to the point, which is there's this whole hospital admission lasts about 24 hours, and it starts to go bad 4 or 5 hours into it when they stop monitoring the patient. You then get a workup by Dr. Koenig, who says, here's the treatment plan, and if it's not followed, she will be referred. Right, then he goes off. Dr. Mathiason, who's not there, is on call.
We're aware of the facts, but I mean the point we're trying to clear up here is that your basic theory is that she was discharged when she should not have been.
That's true.
She should have been kept in the hospital. So whether it was Nurse Short or whoever it was that did it, Overlake is responsible in your mind for that decision. That's why you're suing them.
Well, I think that's basically correct, Your Honor.
Right.
But underlying it is, you know, it'd be one thing if Dr. Koenig had come and looked at her and interviewed her and said, I don't think she meets the criteria, I'm going to discharge. That's one case, and that's his judgment at the time. This is a different case. This is a case where Dr. Koenig says she ought to be detained. And then as a part of Nurse Short's process, for reasons that Overlake admits are negligent, she doesn't go back in the file and get his 6-page report where he goes chapter and verse through what he thinks is wrong and that she currently meets the detention criteria. And he dictates that report at like 4:30 in the afternoon.
Well, I take it that the reason you're talking about this is perhaps to go to the question I was asking about the individual acts of negligence, but might be helpful for you to respond to the basic problem or issue in this case, and that is, why doesn't the Involuntary Treatment Act apply? And your whole argument is the hospital's only duty is to detain. So I guess my most essential question to you is the language in the statute that says any person voluntarily admitted for inpatient treatment shall be released immediately. Shall be released. Whereas the proviso talking about detain is they may detain. Which, reading those two sentences, to me, contradicts your point that there is no duty from that the only duty the hospital has is to detain.
So, Your Honor, I think Your Honor's question is exactly the right one. And the answer, I think, is that you have to look not just at 050, which is what Your Honor was referring to, but you have to look at the immunity provision in 120 as well. So to kind of put some color around the concept here, what 120 says, and the immunity in 120 covers every part of the Involuntary Treatment Act, not just hospitals, but what 120 says is that there's immunity for performing duties pursuant to the Act. So the question is, what does that specific language mean? So under the Act, what this Act is this is an Act that gives the state very limited police power to restrain someone and force them to have involuntary treatment against their will under very certain defined circumstances. What they're saying is, and so our suggestion is this, that the immunity is coextensive with the concept of involuntary treatment. In other words, if you're detained, right, if Overlake holds her on the temporary detention, the very limited detention until the MHP shows up, and so they take that action under the statute, now they are exercising the police power affirmatively under the statute. That's a duty under the statute. There's no discretion around this mandatory discharge. There's no decision that comes with that. All that rule says is, look,
I don't understand why that makes a difference. It seems to me that typically when we encounter the word shall, and it's in a statute where the statute is becoming the source of a duty, shall means the duty.
Well, shall says it's...
Are you saying that the hospital had no duty to release a voluntarily admitted...
No, I'm not saying that at all.
They did have a duty to release her.
I'm saying they had a duty, but it was not a duty pursuant to the immunity provision in the ITA.
Well, but it says pursuant to this chapter. Doesn't this chapter include 05050?
Yes, it does, Your Honor.
And doesn't 05050 have the language which I just read?
Right, it does.
And doesn't that language create a duty pursuant to this chapter?
But again, if you look at the language in 120, what 120 is talking about is performance of duties pursuant to this chapter. In other words, the exercise of police power with regard to the decision.
No, not with respect to the exercise of police power. It's not in that language. It says duties pursuant to this chapter with regard to the decision of, among other things, whether to discharge or release.
Right.
And that seems to imply, wouldn't you say, that there is a duty somewhere in the chapter that regards the discharge and release, and isn't that duty found in 050?
So, again, Your Honor, this exemption applies to the entire gamut of the Involuntary Treatment Act. So it's MHPs, doctors, forcing medication, things of that nature. The question is, how early does the immunity attach? And what we're saying is that the things that happened in this case happened before the immunity should attach, not reading the doctor's chart, not properly communicating in a consultation with the MHP, which is not a referral, not complying with Dr. Mathiasen's order to get an MHP evaluation, substituting her own judgment, all those things.
And what damages did your client suffer as a result of that, or if had not resulted in a release of Mrs. Pelletti?
Well, Your Honor, it's exactly the point. So the question is, can they take this entire string of admittedly negligent conduct and then paint it over? Is that possibly how this statute is intended to function? Is there, there are about 8 or 9 discrete acts of negligence that are conceded by the hospital to have occurred here that all feed into the miscommunication to this doctor that causes him to essentially change his mind and say, okay, let her go, because he's completely misinformed about all the key facts in the case. And what they want to say is they want to go to trial and say, oh, it doesn't matter, because all we have to do is slight negligence, and the nurse talked to her, and geez, what do you want from us, right? That's why we're here, because as we got closer to trial, that was the argument that was being advanced in the case.
Have you thought about how you would instruct this jury? I know that you have your thought about how you would instruct the jury if you prevail in this appeal, but if you do not, and if we hold that a gross negligence standard under the Act is appropriate, have you thought about how that
Yeah, that, it, that at most, that that would apply not to what Nurse Short did, because she doesn't have the discretion to do these things. She's working at the hospital pursuant to the rules. The person who issues the verbal discharge order is Dr. Mathiasen. And at the very most, this standard would apply to his thought process only. But there are so many other causative factors here, which are...
That isn't exactly my question. My question is, if you thought about how you're going to instruct the jury, you're going to have various instructions, I assume, based on my reading of the WPI, you'd probably have both a gross negligence and a negligence instruction, and then you'd have a claims of the parties instruction.
If Your Honor, if this court ruled in the manner Your Honor is suggesting, it seems to me the jury instructions would say something along the lines of gross negligence applies discreetly to the conduct of Dr. Mathiasen, but does not apply to the independent acts of negligence that lead up to or precede or post-date, for that matter, his discharge order. The most egregious thing in the case, I think, factually, is that Dr. Koenig, who's evaluated this patient for over an hour, writes an order that says, here's the treatment plan. If she doesn't start taking her medication, she will be referred. So that's the standing order.
But don't you have to have a theory whereby your acts of negligence that you allege are linked, at least arguably, to the element of causation, which is just discharge? That's the only thing that, at least as far as I've heard, caused Ms. Pelletti any damage.
Is there, if Dr. Mathiasen had been accurately informed, is there any possibility that he would have taken the action that he took when the chairman of his department and his supervisor an hour earlier has dictated a report that says, I want her referred if she doesn't follow the treatment plan? And nobody reads that or tells that to him. He's on the phone. It's New Year's Eve. Is there any conceivable way that he does what he does if he's apprised of the accurate facts? And similarly, if he's told accurately what the MHP is reporting to Nurse Short, does he possibly do the things that he did? And the problem is, those things, in any other case, failing to read the patient's chart would be ordinary negligence. I see I've exceeded my time.
Can I hold you over for just 30 seconds? What's the status of your implied consent theory if this goes back?
So my recollection is that it was denied without prejudice, and I was surprised. I need to go back and look at that order, but that's my recollection. And the relevance of that approach is this. In speaking in a very sort of global way, Overlake's position is, well, she was suitable for discharge. She didn't meet the detention criteria. But they also concede that they didn't give her any of the warnings that are required not only by their own policies but also by informed consent. And in this particular case, no reasonable person who was suffering from delusions, off their medication, thought people were tracking them because of their tooth, driving to avoid people they thought were following them, sores on her face that don't really exist, no reasonable person confronted with those facts would accept the course of treatment that was being recommended. And the informed consent theory is an objective theory, not a subjective theory.
Thank you. In 4 minutes.
Okay. The informed consent claim was denied without prejudice because of the stay. Yes, that's correct. But it isn't really part and parcel of this appeal because it wasn't anything that the trial court considered.
It was not denied on the merits or because of untimeliness?
No, I think the order is clear that it was denied because the parties had already agreed to the stay to resolve the issues that are before the court as to what standard of liability should apply.
Postponed.
Yes. So it is a claim that may get resurrected on remand, but as yet it's not before this court. I think the thrust of plaintiff's argument is that that no one was performing duties under the Act, and thus immunity doesn't apply. And I think that in deciding whether to discharge or detain Ms. Pelletti for a mental health professional evaluation, Nurse Short most certainly was performing a duty under the Involuntary Treatment Act, because she had an absolute duty under the statute to discharge Ms. Poletti immediately upon request unless she or anyone else evaluating her regarded her as meeting the statutorily specified detainability criteria. Then under RCW 7105120, gross negligence and bad faith are the liability standards that apply to decisions of whether to discharge or detain a voluntarily admitted patient. And so clearly...
You and counsel for the estate are seem to keep getting into this argument about whether it was Nurse Short or whether it was somebody else. I'm having trouble understanding that argument. Is that going to come up in the trial court? Is that really something this court needs to address?
I don't think so. Dr. Mathiasen ultimately signed the order and concurred in the decision that the patient should be discharged because the detainability criteria were not met at that point in time.
Was it too late then? I mean, had the, what is it, a 24-hour period or something like that, that the hospital has to think about whether they want to detain?
No, it wasn't too late at that point because basically she was a voluntarily admitted patient. So once she requested discharge, they had the duty to discharge her immediately unless the detainability criteria, she was regarded as having the detainability criteria. So there wasn't a time frame. We weren't into an involuntary commitment or even to the point of the MHP evaluation other than the consultation that occurred with the MHP at that point.
So, but in terms of the hospital's liability for negligence, there seems to be an argument from Mr. Goldfarb that you can say whatever you want about Nurse Short. Maybe she was grossly negligent, but or whoever it was, I guess maybe Dr. Whoever it was that can be singled out as having signed the order of release or discharge, that person might be held under a gross negligence standard. But there's a lot of other stuff that's going to come in under a negligence standard.
Except that, again, those other things, absent whatever impact they had on that decision, whether to discharge or detain, are not causally related, absent that discharge decision.
Are you anticipating that the trial judge is going to have to face a decision on an instruction that says, well, gross negligence applies to acts X, Y, and Z, but ordinary negligence applies to other things?
It may. And, again, it depends on what it turns out those other things are and whether those other things standing alone apart from influencing the final decision whether to discharge or detain are causally related to the wrongful death of the alleged wrongful death.
So you anticipate this argument being carried on in the trial court if this is sent back for
I don't think that in the posture of the case as it currently stands there's a basis for parsing out all of those things, and the trial court hasn't been asked to parse those things out. She issued a blanket ruling that ordinary negligence malpractice standard of care is going to apply, and that decision is erroneous.
All right.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both very much.